Heads and Skins. 1. It's not pain that wakes Freddy, but her bladder. It feels like it's bursting. Getting out of bed is a major operation. Her head is banging, and it feels like she's wearing a plaster cast on her chest. It doesn't hurt too much. Mostly it's just stiff and so heavy. Each breath is a clean and jerk. The bathroom looks like something out of a slasher movie, and she closes her eyes as soon as she sits on the john so she won't have to look at all the blood. So lucky to be alive, she thinks, as something that feels like 10 gallons of pee rushes out of her. Just so goddamn lucky. And why am I in the center of this clusterfuck? Because I took him that picture. My mother was right, no good deed goes unpunished. But if there was ever a time for clear thinking, it's now. And she has to admit to herself that taking Brady the picture wasn't what has led her to this place, sitting in her bloody bathroom with a knot on her head and a gunshot wound in her chest. It was going back that had done that. And she'd gone back because she was being paid to do so. $50 a visit, which made her sort of a call girl, she supposed. You know what all this is about. You could tell yourself you only knew when you peeked at the thumb drive Dr. Z brought you, the one that activates the creepy website. But you knew when you were installing updates on all those Zap-its, didn't you? A regular assembly line of them, 40 or 50 a day, until all the ones that weren't defective were loaded landmines. Over 500. You knew it was Brady all along, and Brady Hartsfield is crazy. She yanks up her pants, flushes, and leaves the bathroom. The light coming in the living room window is muted, but it still hurts her eyes. She squints, sees it starting to snow, and shuffles to the kitchen, working for every breath. Her fridge is mostly stocked with cartons of leftover Chinese, but there's a couple of cans of Red Bull in the door shelf. She grabs one, chugs half, and feels a bit better. It's probably a psychological effect, but she'll take it. What am I going to do? What in the name of God? Is there any way out of this mess? She goes into her computer room, shuffling a little faster now, and refreshes her screen. She Googles her way to Z the End, hoping she'll get the cartoon man swinging his cartoon pickaxe, and her heart sinks when the picture filling the screen shows a candlelit funeral parlor instead. Exactly what she saw when she booted up the thumb drive and looked at the starter screen, instead of just importing the whole thing blind as instructed. That dopey Blue Oyster Cult song is playing. She scrolls past the messages below the coffin, each one swelling and fading like slow heartbeats. An end to pain. An end to fear. And clicks on Post a Comment. Freddy doesn't know how long this electronic poison pill has been active, but long enough for it to have generated hundreds of comments already. Be darkened 77. This dares to speak the truth. Alice Always 401. I wish I had the guts. Things are so bad at home now. Verbena the Monkey. Bear the pain, people. Suicide is gutless. Kitty Cat Green Eyes. No. Suicide is painless. It brings on many changes. Verbena the Monkey isn't the only naysayer, but Freddy doesn't have to scroll through all the comments to see that he or she is very much in the minority. This is going to spread like the flu, Freddy thinks. No, more like Ebola. She looks up at the repeater just in time to see 171 found tick up to 172. Word about the number fish is spreading fast, and by tonight, almost all of the rigged Zap-its will be active. The demo screen hypnotizes them, makes them receptive. To what? Well, to the idea that they should visit Z the End, for one thing. Or maybe the Zap-it people won't even have to go there. Maybe they'll just high-side it. Will people obey a hypnotic command to off themselves? Surely not, right? Right? Freddy doesn't dare risk killing the repeater for fear of a return visit from Brady. But the website? You're going down, motherfucker, she says, and begins to rattle away at her keyboard. Less than 30 seconds later, she's staring with disbelief at a message on her screen. "This function is not allowed." She reaches out to try again, then stops. For all she knows, another go at the website may nuke all her stuff, not just her computer equipment, but her credit cards, her bank account, her cell phone, even her fucking driver's license. If anyone knows how to program such evil shit, it's Brady. Fuck. I have to get out of here. She'll throw some clothes in a suitcase, call a cab, go to the bank, and draw out everything she's got. There might be as much as $4,000. In her heart, she knows it's more like three. From the bank to the bus station. The snow swirling outside her window is supposed to be the beginning of a big storm, and that may preclude a quick getaway, but if she has to wait a few hours at the station, she will. Hell, if she has to sleep there, she will. This is all Brady. He set up an elaborate Jonestown protocol of which the rigged Zappets are only a part, and she helped him do it. Freddy has no idea if it will work, and she doesn't intend to wait around to find out. She's sorry for the people who might be sucked in by the Zappets or tipped into attempting suicide by that fucking Z the End website instead of just thinking about it, but she has to take care of numero uno. There's no one else to do it. Freddy makes her way back to the bedroom as rapidly as she can. She gets her old Samsonite from the closet, and then oxygen depletion caused by shallow breathing and too much excitement turns her legs to rubber. She makes it to the bed, sits on it, and lowers her head. Easy does it, she thinks. Get your breath back, one thing at a time. Only thanks to her foolish effort to crash the website, she doesn't know how much time she has, and when Boogie Woogie Bugle Boy begins to play from the top of her dresser, she utters a little scream. Freddy doesn't want to answer her phone, but gets up anyway. Sometimes it's better to know. 2. The snow remains light until Brady gets off the interstate at exit 7, but on State Road 79, he's out in the boondocks now. It starts to come down a little harder. The tar is still bare and wet, but the snow will start to accumulate on it soon enough, and he's still 40 miles from where he intends to hole up and get busy. Lake Charles, he thinks, where the real fun begins. That's when Babineau's laptop awakens and chimes 3 times, an alert Brady programmed into it, because safe is always better than sorry. He has no time to pull over, not when he's racing this goddamn storm, but he can't afford not to. Ahead on the right is a boarded-up building with 2 metal girls in rusting bikinis on the roof holding up a sign reading Porno Palace and XXX and We Dare to Bear. In the middle of the dirt parking lot, which the snow is now starting to sugarcoat, there's a for sale sign. Brady pulls in, shifts to park, and opens the laptop. The message on the screen puts a significant crack right down the middle of his good mood. 11:04 a.m. Unauthorized attempt to modify, cancel, ztheend.com. Denied. Site active. He opens the Malibu's glove compartment, and there is Al Brooks' battered cell phone, right where he always kept it. A good thing, too, because Brady forgot to bring Babineau's. So sue me, he thinks. You can't remember everything, and I've been busy. He doesn't bother going to contacts, just dials Freddy's number from memory. She hasn't changed it since the old discount electronics days. 3. When Hodges excuses himself to use the bathroom, Jerome waits until he's out the door, then goes to Holly, who's standing at the window and watching the snow fall. It's still light here in the city, the flakes dancing in the air and seeming to defy gravity. Holly once more has her arms crossed over her chest so she can grip her shoulders. How bad is he? Jerome asks in a low voice. Because he doesn't look good.
It's pancreatic cancer, Jerome. How good does anyone look with that?
Can he get through the day, do you think? Because he wants to, and I really think he could use some closure on this.
closure on Hartsfield, you mean? Brady fracking Hartsfield, even though he's fracking dead.
Yes, that's what I mean.
I think it's bad. She turns to him and forces herself to meet his eyes, a thing that always makes her feel stripped bare. Do you see the way he keeps putting his hand against his side?
Jerome nods.
He's been doing that for weeks now, and calling it indigestion. He only went to the doctor because I nagged him into it, and when he found out what was wrong, he tried to lie.
You didn't answer the question. Can he get through the day?
I think so. I hope so. Because you're right. He needs this. Only we have to stick with him. Both of us.
She releases one shoulder so she can grip his wrist.
Promise me, Jerome, no sending the skinny girl home so the boys can play in the treehouse by themselves.
He pries her hand loose and gives it a squeeze. Don't worry, Holly Berry. No one's breaking up the band.
4.
Hello? Is that you, Dr. Z?
Brady has no time to play games with her. The snow is thickening every second, and Z-Boy's crappy old Malibu, with no snow tires and over 100,000 miles on the clock, will be no match for the storm once it really gets whooping. Under other circumstances, he'd want to know how she's even alive, but since he has no intention of turning back and rectifying that situation, it's a moot question.
You know who it is, and I know what you tried to do. Try it again, and I'll send in the men who are watching the building. You're lucky to be alive, Freddy. I wouldn't tempt fate a second time.
I'm sorry.
Almost whispering. This is not the fuck you and fuck your mother riot girl Brady worked with on the cyber patrol. Yet she's not entirely broken, or she wouldn't have tried messing with the computer gear. Have you told anyone?
No!
She sounds horrified at the thought. Horrified is good. Will you?
No!
That's the right answer, because if you do, I'll know. You're under surveillance, Freddy. Remember it.
He ends the call without waiting for a reply, more furious with her for being alive than for what she tried to do. Will she believe that fictitious men are watching the building, even though he left her for dead? He thinks so. She's had dealings with both Dr. Z and Z-Boy. Who knows how many other drones he might have at his command? In any case, there's nothing else he can do about it now. Brady has a long, long history of blaming others for his problems, and now he blames Freddy for not dying when she was supposed to. He drops the Malibu's gear shift into drive and steps on the gas. The tires spin in the thin carpet of snow covering the defunct Porno Palace's parking lot, but catch once they get on the state road again, where the formerly brown soft shoulders are now turning white. Brady eases Z-Boy's car up to 60. That will soon be too fast for conditions, but he'll hold the needle there as long as he can.
5. Finders Keepers shares the 7th floor bathrooms with the travel agency, but right now Hodges has the men's to himself, for which he is grateful. He's bent over one of the sinks, right hand gripping the wash basin's rim, left pressed to his side. His belt is still unbuckled, and his pants are sinking past his hips under the weight of the stuff in his pockets. Change, keys, wallet, phone. He came in here to take a shit, an ordinary excretory function he's been performing all his life, but when he started to strain, the left half of his midsection went nuclear. It makes his previous pain seem like a bunch of warm-up notes before the full concert begins, and if it's this bad now, he dreads to think what may lie ahead. No, he thinks, dread is the wrong word. Terror is the right one. For the first time in my life, I'm terrified of the future, where I see everything that I am or ever was first submerged, then erased. If the pain itself doesn't do it, the heavier drugs they give me to stifle it will. Now he understands why pancreatic is called the stealth cancer, and why it's almost always deadly. It lurks, building up its troops and sending out secret emissaries to the lungs, the lymph nodes, the bones, and the brain. Then it blitzkriegs, not understanding, in its stupid rapacity, that victory can only bring its own death. Hodges thinks, except maybe that's what it wants. Maybe it's self-hating, born with a desire not to murder the host, but to kill itself, which makes cancer the real suicide prince. He brings up a long, resounding burp, and that makes him feel a little better, who knows why. It won't last long, but he'll take any measure of relief he can get. He shakes out three of his painkillers, already they make him think of shooting a pop gun at a charging elephant, and swallows them with water from the tap. Then he splashes more cold water on his face, trying to bring up a little color. When that doesn't work, he slaps himself briskly, two hard ones on each cheek. Holly and Jerome must not know how bad it's gotten. He was promised this day, and he means to take every minute of it, all the way to midnight if necessary. He's leaving the bathroom, reminding himself to straighten up and stop pressing his side when his phone buzzes. Pete wanting to resume his bitch-a-thon, he thinks, but it's not. It's Norma Wilmer.
"I found that file," she says. "The one the late, great Ruth Scapelli..."
"Yeah," he says. "The visitors list. Who's on it?"
"There is no list."
He leans against the wall and closes his eyes. "Shh."
"But there is a single memo with Babineau's letterhead on it. It says, and I quote, Frederica Linkletter to be admitted both during and after visiting hours. She is aiding in B. Hartsfield's recovery. Does that help?"
Some girl with a marine haircut, Hodges thinks. A ratty chick with a bunch of tats. It rang no bells at the time, but there was that faint vibration, and now he knows why. He met a skinny girl with buzz-cut hair at Discount Electronics back in 2010 when he, Jerome, and Holly were closing in on Brady. Even 6 years later, he can remember what she said about her co-worker on the cyber patrol.
"It's something with his mom, bet you anything. He's freaky about her."
"Are you still there?" Norma sounds irritated. "Yeah, but I have to go."
"Didn't you say there'd be some extra money if..."
"Yeah, I'll take care of you, Norma." He ends the call. The pills are doing their work, and he's able to manage a medium-fast walk back to the office. Holly and Jerome are at the window overlooking Lower Marlborough Street, and he can tell by their expressions when they turn to the sound of the opening door that they've been talking about him, but he has no time to think about that, or brood on it. What he's thinking about are those rigged Zappets. The question, ever since they started to put things together, was how Brady could have had anything to do with modifying them when he was stuck in a hospital room and barely able to walk. But he knew somebody who almost certainly had the skills to do it for him, didn't he? Someone he used to work with. Somebody who came to visit him in the bucket with Babineau's written approval. A punky chick with a lot of tats and a yard of attitude.
Brady's visitor, his only visitor, was a woman named Frederica Linkletter. She...
"Cyber Patrol!"
Holly nearly screams.
"He worked with her!"
"Right. There was also a third guy. The boss, I think. Do either of you remember his name?"
Holly and Jerome look at each other, then shake their heads. "That was a long time ago, Bill," Jerome says, "and we were concentrating on Hartsfield by then."
"Yeah, I only remember Linkletter because she was sort of unforgettable."
"Can I use your computer?" Jerome asks. "Maybe I can find the guy while Holly looks for the girl's addy."
"Sure, go for it." Holly is at hers already, sitting bolt upright and clicking away. She's also talking out loud, as she often does when she's deeply involved in something.
"Frack. White Pages doesn't have a number or address. Long shot, anyway. A lot of single women don't... Wait, hold the fracking phone. Here's her Facebook page."
"I'm not really interested in her summer vacation snaps or how many friends she's got," Hodges says.
"Are you sure about that? Because she's only got 6 friends, and one of them is Anthony Frobisher. I'm pretty sure that was the name of the..."
"Frobisher!" Jerome yells from Hodges' office.
"Anthony Frobisher was the third Civil Patrol guy."
"Beat you, Jerome,"
Holly says. She looks smug.
"Again."
6.
Unlike Frederica Linklater, Anthony Frobisher is listed, both as himself and as your computer guru. Both numbers are the same, his cell, Hodges assumes. He evicts Jerome from his office chair and settles there himself, doing it slowly and carefully. The explosion of pain he felt while sitting on the toilet is still fresh in his mind. The phone is answered on the first ring.
Computer guru Tony Frobisher speaking. How can I help you?
Mr. Frobisher, this is Bill Hodges. You probably don't remember me, but...
Oh, I remember you, all right.
Frobisher sounds wary.
What do you want? If it's about Hartsfield...
It's about Frederica Linklater. Do you have a current address for her?
Freddy? Why would I have any address for her? I haven't seen her since D.E. closed.
Really? According to her Facebook page, you and she are friends.
Frobisher laughs incredulously.
Who else has she got listed? Kim Jong-un? Charles Manson? Listen, Mr. Hodges, that smart-mouth bitch has no friends. The closest thing to one was Hartsfield, and I just got a news push on my phone saying he's dead.
Hodges has no idea what a news push is and no desire to learn. He thanks Frobisher and hangs up. He's guessing that none of Freddie Linklater's half-dozen Facebook friends are real friends, that she just added them to keep from feeling like a total outcast. Holly might have done that same thing once upon a time, but now she actually has friends. Lucky for her, and lucky for them. Which begs the question, how does he locate Freddie Linklater? The outfit he and Holly runs isn't called Finders Keepers for nothing, but most of their specialized search engines are constructed to locate bad people with bad friends, long police records, and colorful want sheets. He can find her. In this computerized age, few people are able to drop entirely off the grid, but he needs it to happen fast. Every time some kid turns on one of those free Zap-its, it's loading up pink fish, blue flashes, and, based on Jerome's experience, a subliminal message suggesting that a visit to Z the End would be in order.
You're a detective. One with cancer, granted, but still a detective. So let go of the extraneous shit and detect. It's hard, though. The thought of all those kids, the ones Brady tried and failed to kill at the Round Here concert, keeps getting in the way. Jerome's sister was one of them. And if not for Doris Neville, Barbara might be dead now instead of just in a leg cast. Maybe hers was a test model. Maybe the Ellerton woman's was, too. That makes a degree of sense. But now, there are all those other Zap-its, a flood of them, and they must have gone somewhere, goddammit. That finally turns on a light bulb.
Holly, I need a phone number.
7.
Todd Schneider is in and affable.
I understand you folks are in for quite a storm, Mr. Hodges.
So they say.
Having any luck tracking down those defective consoles?
That's actually why I'm calling. Do you happen to have the address that consignment of Zap-It Commanders was sent to?
Of course. Can I call you back with it?
How about if I hang on? It's rather urgent.
An urgent consumer advocacy issue?
Schneider sounds bemused.
That sounds almost un-American. Let me see what I can do.
A click, and Hodges is on hold, complete with soothing strings that fail to soothe. Holly and Jerome are both in the office now, crowding the desk. Hodges makes an effort not to put his hand to his side. The seconds stretch out and form a minute. Then 2. Hodges thinks, either he's on another call and forgotten me, or he can't find it. The hold music disappears.
Mr. Hodges? Still there?
Still here.
I have that address. It's Games Unlimited, Games with a Z, if you remember, at 442 Maritime Drive, care of Ms. Frederica Linklater. Does that help?
It sure does. Thank you, Mr. Schneider.
He hangs up and looks at his two associates, one slender and winter pale, the other bulked up from his house building stint in Arizona. Along with his daughter Allie, now living on the other side of the country, they are the people he loves most at this end of his life. He says, let's take a ride, kids.
8.
Brady turns off SR-79 and onto Vale Road at Thurston's Garage, where a number of local plow-for-pay boys are gassing their trucks, loading up with salted sand, or just standing around drinking coffee and jabbering. It crosses Brady's mind to pull in and see if he can get some studded snow tires on Library Al's Malibu, but given the crowd the storm has brought to the garage, it would probably take all afternoon. He's close to his destination now, and decides to go for it. If he gets snowed in once he's there, who gives a shit? Not him. He's been out to the camp twice already, mostly to scope the place out, but the second time, he also laid in some supplies. There's a good 3 inches of snow on Vale Road, and the going is greasy. The Malibu slides several times, once almost all the way to the ditch. He's sweating heavily, and Babineau's arthritic fingers are throbbing from Brady's death grip on the steering wheel. At last, he sees the tall red posts that are his final landmark. Brady pumps the brakes and makes the turn at walking pace. The last 2 miles are on an unnamed one-lane camp road, but thanks to the overarching trees, the driving here is the easiest he's had in the last hour. In some places, the road is still bare. That won't last once the main body of the storm arrives, which will happen around 8 o'clock tonight, according to the radio. He comes to a fork, where wooden arrows nailed to a huge old-growth fir point in different directions. The one on the right reads, Big Bob's Bear Camp. The one on the left reads, Heads and Skins. 10 feet or so above the arrows, already wearing a thin hood of snow, a security camera peers down. Brady turns left and finally allows his hands to relax. He's almost there. 9. In the city, the snow is still light. The streets are clear and traffic is moving well, but the three of them pile into Jerome's Jeep Wrangler just to be on the safe side. 442 Maritime Drive turns out to be one of the condos that sprang up like mushrooms on the south side of the lake in the go-go 80s. Back then, they were a big deal. Now, most are half empty. In the foyer, Jerome finds F. Linkladder in 6A. He reaches for the buzzer, but Hodges stops him before he can push it. What? Jerome asks. Holly says primly, Watch and learn, Jerome. This is how we roll. Hodges pushes other buttons at random and gets a male voice in return on the fourth try. Yeah? FedEx, Hodges says. Who'd send me something by FedEx? The voice sounds mystified. Couldn't tell you, buddy. I don't make the news. I just report it. The door to the lobby gives out an ill-tempered rattle. Hodges pushes through and holds it for the others. There are 2 elevators, one with an out-of-order sign taped to it. On the one that works, someone has posted a note that reads, Whoever has the barking dog on 4, I will find you. I find that rather ominous, Jerome says. The elevator door opens, and as they get in, Holly begins to rummage in her purse. She finds her box of Nicorette and pops one. When the elevator opens on the 6th floor, Hodges says, If she's there, let me do the talking. 6A is directly across from the elevator. Hodges knocks. When there's no answer, he raps. When there's still no answer, he hammers with the side of his fist. Go away. The voice on the other side of the door sounds weak and thin. The voice of a little girl with the flu, Hodges thinks. He hammers again. Open up, Ms. Linkladder.
Are you the police?
He could say yes. It wouldn't be the first time since retiring from the force that he impersonated a police officer, but instinct tells him not to do it this time.
No, my name is Bill Hodges. We met before briefly back in 2010. It was when you worked at...
Yeah, I remember.
One lock turns, then another. A chain falls. The door opens, and the tangy smell of pot wafts into the corridor. The woman in the doorway has got a half-smoked fatty tweezed between the thumb and forefinger of her left hand. She's thin almost to the point of emaciation and pale as milk. She's wearing a strappy T-shirt with Bad Boy Bail Bonds, Bradenton, Florida, on the front. Below this is the motto, In jail, we bail. But that part is hard to read because of the blood stain.
I should have called you,
Freddy says,
and although she's looking at Hodges, he has an idea it's really herself she's speaking to.
I would have, if I'd thought of it. You stopped him before, right?
Jesus, lady, what happened? Jerome asks.
I probably packed too much.
Freddie gestures at a pair of mismatched suitcases standing behind her in the living room.
I should have listened to my mother. She said to always travel light.
I don't think he's talking about the suitcases, Hodges says, cocking a thumb at the fresh blood on Freddie's shirt. He steps in, Jerome and Holly right behind him. Holly closes the door.
I know what he's talking about, Freddie says. Fucker shot me. Bleeding started again when I hauled the suitcases out of the bedroom.
Let me see, Hodges says, but when he steps toward her, Freddie takes a compensatory step back and crosses her arms in front of her. A Holly-esque gesture that touches Hodges' heart.
No, I'm not wearing a bra. Hurts too much.
Holly pushes past Hodges.
Show me where the bathroom is. Let me look.
She sounds okay to Hodges. Calm, but she's chewing the shit out of that nicotine gum.
Freddie takes Holly by the wrist and leads her past the suitcases, pausing a moment to hit the joint. She lets the smoke out in a series of smoke signals as she talks.
The equipment is in the spare room, on your right. Get a good look.
And then returning to her original scripture,
if I hadn't packed so much, I'd be gone now.
Hodges doubts it. He thinks she would have passed out in the elevator.
10.
Heads and Skins isn't as big as the Babineau McMansion in Sugar Heights, but damned near. It's long, low, and rambling. Beyond it, the snow-covered ground slopes down to Lake Charles, which has frozen over since Brady's last visit. He parks in front and walks carefully around to the west side, Babineau's expensive loafers sliding in the accumulating snow. The hunting camp is in a clearing, so there's a lot more snow to slip around in. His ankles are freezing. He wishes he'd thought to bring some boots, and once more reminds himself that you can't think of everything. He takes the key to the generator shed from inside the electric meter box, and the keys to the house from inside the shed. The Jenny is a top-of-the-line Generac Guardian. It's silent now, but will probably kick on later. Out here in the boonies, the electricity goes down in almost every storm. Brady returns to the car for Babineau's laptop. The camp is Wi-Fi equipped, and the laptop is all he needs to keep him connected to his current project and abreast of developments. Plus the Zap-It, of course. Good old Zap-It Zero. The house is dark and chilly, and his first acts upon entering are the prosaic ones any returning homeowner might perform. He turns on the lights and boosts the thermostat. The main room is huge and pine-paneled, lit by a chandelier made of polished caribou bones from back in the days when there were still caribou in these woods. The field stone fireplace is a maw, almost big enough to roast a rhino in. Overhead are thick, crisscrossing beams, darkened by years of wood smoke from the fireplace. Next to one wall stands a cherry wood buffet as long as the room itself, lined with at least 50 liquor bottles, some nearly empty, some with the seals still intact. The furniture is old, mismatched, and plushy. Deep easy chairs, and a gigantic sofa where innumerable bimbos have been banged over the years. Plenty of extramarital fucking has gone on out here in addition to the hunting and fishing. The skin in front of the fireplace belonged to a bear brought down by Dr. Elton Marchant, who has now gone to that great operating room in the sky. The mounted heads and stuffed fish are trophies belonging to nearly a dozen other docs, past and present. There's a particularly fine 16-point buck that Babineau himself brought down back when he was really Babineau. Out of season, but what the hell. Brady puts the laptop on an antique roll-top desk at the far end of the room and fires it up before taking off his coat. First, he checks in on the repeater and is delighted to see it's now reading 243 found. He thought he understood the power of the eye trap and has seen how addictive that demo screen is even before it's juiced up. But this is success beyond his wildest expectations. far beyond. There haven't been any new warning chimes from Z the End, but he goes there next anyway just to see how it's doing. Once again, his expectations are exceeded. Over 7,000 visitors so far. 7,000. And the number ticks up steadily even as he watches. He drops his coat and does a nimble little dance on the bearskin rug. It tires him out fast. When he makes his next switch, he'll be sure to choose someone in their 20s or 30s, but it warms him up nicely. He snags the TV remote from the buffet and clicks on the enormous flat screen, one of the camp's few nods to life in the 21st century. The satellite dish pulls in God knows how many channels, and the HD picture is to die for, but Brady is more interested in local programming today. He punches the source button on the remote until he's looking back down the camp road leading to the outside world. He doesn't expect company, but he has two or three busy days ahead of him, the most important and productive days of his life, and if someone tries to interrupt him, he wants to know about it beforehand. The gun closet is a walk-in job, the knotty pine walls lined with rifles and hung with pistols on pegs. The pick of the litter, as far as Brady's concerned, is the FN SCAR 17S with the pistol grip. Capable of firing 650 rounds a minute and illegally converted to full auto by a proctologist who is also a gun nut, it is the Rolls-Royce of grease guns. Brady takes it out, along with a few extra clips and several heavy boxes of Winchester 308s, and props it against the wall beside the fireplace. He thinks about starting a fire. Seasoned wood is already stacked in the hearth, but he has one other thing to do first. He goes to the site for city-breaking news and scrolls down rapidly, looking for suicides. None yet, but he can remedy that. Call it a zappetizer, he says, grinning, and powers up the console. He makes himself comfortable in one of the easy chairs and begins following the pink fish. When he closes his eyes, they're still there. At first, anyway. Then they become red dots moving on a field of black. Brady picks one at random and goes to work.
11. Hodges and Jerome are staring at a digital display reading 244 found when Holly leads Freddy into her computer room.
She's all right, Holly says quietly to Hodges. She shouldn't be, but she is. She's got a hole in her chest that looks like what I said it is.
Freddy sounds a little stronger now. Her eyes are red, but that's probably from the dope she's been smoking.
He shot me.
She had some mini pads, and I taped one over the wound, Holly says. It was too big for a band-aid. She wrinkles her nose.
Ooh. Fucker shot me.
It's as if Freddy's still trying to get it straight in her mind. Which fucker would that be? Hodges asks. Felix Babineau?
Yeah, him. Fucking Dr. Z. Only he's really Brady. So is the other one, Z-Boy.
Z-Boy? Jerome asks. Who the hell is Z-Boy? Older guy? Hodges asks. Older than Babineau? Frizzy white hair? Drives a beater with primer paint on it? Maybe wears a parka with tape over some of the rips?
I don't know about his car, but I know the parka, Freddy says. That's my boy Z-Boy.
She sits in front of her desktop Mac, currently spinning out a fractal screensaver, and takes a final drag on her joint before crushing it out in an ashtray full of Marlboro butts. She's still pale, but some of the fuck you attitude Hodges remembers from their previous meeting is coming back.
Dr. Z and his faithful sidekick Z-Boy, except they're both Brady. Fucking Matryoshka dolls is what they are.
Ms. Linkletter, Holly says.
Oh, go ahead and call me Freddy. Any chick who sees the teacups I call tits gets to call me Freddy.
Holly blushes but goes ahead. When she's on the scent, she always does.
Brady Hartsfield is dead. It was an overdose last night or early this morning.
Elvis has left the building?
Freddy considers the idea, then shakes her head.
Wouldn't that be nice? If it was true.
And wouldn't it be nice I could totally believe she's crazy, Hodges thinks. Jerome points at the readout above her jumbo monitor. It's now flashing 247 found. Is that thing searching or downloading?
Both. Freddy's hand is pressing at the makeshift bandage under his shirt in an automatic gesture that reminds Hodges of himself.
It's a repeater. I can turn it off. At least I think I can. But you have to promise to protect me from the men who are watching the building. The website, though, no good. I've got the IP address and the password, but I still couldn't crash the server.
Hodges has 1,000 questions, but as 247 found clicks up to 248, only two seem of paramount importance. What's it searching for, and what's it downloading?
You have to promise me protection first. You have to take me somewhere safe, witness protection or whatever.
He doesn't have to promise you anything, because I already know,
Holly says. There's nothing mean in her tone. If anything, it's comforting.
It's searching for Zappets, Bill. Each time somebody turns one on, the repeater finds it and upgrades the fish and hole demo screen.
Turns the pink fish into number fish and adds the blue flashes, Jerome amplifies. He looks at Freddy. That's what it's doing, right? Now, it's the purple blood-caked lump on her forehead that her hand goes to. When her fingers touch it, she winces and pulls back her hand.
Yeah. Of the 800 Zappets that were delivered here, 280 were defective. They either froze while they were booting up or went kabloosh the first time you tried to open one of the games. The others were okay. I had to install a rootkit into each and every one of them. It was a lot of work. Boring work. Like attaching widgets to widgets on an assembly line.
That means 520 were okay, Hodges says.
The man can subtract, give him a cigar.
Freddy glances at the readout. And almost half of them have updated already.
She laughs, a sound with absolutely no humor in it.
Brady may be nuts, but he worked this out pretty good, don't you think?
Hodges says, turn it off.
Sure, when you promise to protect me.
Jerome, who has first-hand experience with how fast the Zappets work and what unpleasant ideas they implant in a person's mind, has no interest in standing by while Freddy tries to dicker with Bill. The Swiss Army knife he carried on his belt while in Arizona has been retrieved from his luggage and is now back in his pocket. He unfolds the biggest blade, shoves the repeater off its shelf, and slices the cables mating it to Freddy's system. It falls to the floor with a moderate crash, and an alarm begins to bong from the CPU under the desk. Holly bends down, pushes something, and the alarm shuts up.
There's a switch, moron! Freddy shouts. You didn't have to do that!
You know what? I did, Jerome says. One of those fucking Zappets almost got my sister killed. He steps toward her, and Freddy cringes back. Did you have any idea what you were doing? Any fucking idea at all? I think you must have. You look stoned, but not stupid.
Freddy begins to cry.
I didn't. I swear I didn't, because I didn't want to.
Hodges takes a deep breath, which reawakens the pain. Start from the beginning, Freddy, and take us through it.
And as quickly as you can, Holly adds.
12. Jamie Winters was 9 when he attended the Round Here concert at the Mac with his mother. Only a few sub-teen boys were there that night. The group was one of those dismissed by most boys his age as girly stuff. Jamie, however, liked girly stuff. At 9, he hadn't yet been sure that he was gay. Wasn't even sure he knew what that meant. All he knew was that when he saw Cam Knowles, Round Here's lead singer, he felt funny in the pit of his stomach. Now, he's pushing 16 and knows exactly what he is. With certain boys at school, he prefers to leave off the last letter of his first name, E, because with those boys, he likes to be J-A-M-I. His father knows what he is as well, and treats him like some kind of freak. Lenny Winters, a man's man if ever there was one, owns a successful building company, but today, all 4 of Winters Construction's current jobs are shut down because of the impending storm. Lenny is in his home office instead, up to his ears in paperwork and stewing over the spreadsheets covering his computer screen.
Dad!
What do you want? Lenny growls without looking up.
And why aren't you in school? Was it canceled?
Dad!
This time, Lenny looks around at the boy he sometimes refers to when he thinks Jamie isn't in earshot as the family queer. The first thing he's aware of is that his son is wearing lipstick, rouge, and eyeshadow. The second thing is the dress. Lenny recognizes it as one of his wife's. The kid is too tall for it, and it stops halfway down his thighs.
What the fuck?
Jamie is smiling, jubilant.
It's how I want to be buried.
What are you?
Lenny gets up so fast his chair tumbles over. That's when he sees the gun the boy is holding. He must have taken it from Lenny's side of the closet in the master bedroom.
Watch this, Dad.
Still smiling, as if about to demonstrate a really cool magic trick, he raises the gun and places the muzzle against his right temple. His finger is curled around the trigger. The nail has been carefully coated with sparkle polish.
Put that down, son. Put it.
Jamie, or Jamie, which is how he assigned his brief suicide note, pulls the trigger. The gun is a .357, and the report is deafening. Blood and brains fly in a fan and decorate the doorframe with gaud. The boy in his mother's dress and makeup falls forward, the left side of his face pushed out like a balloon. Lenny Winters gives voice to a series of high, wavering screams. He screams like a girl. 13. Brady disconnects from Jamie Winters just as the boy puts the gun to his head, afraid, terrified actually, of what may happen if he's still in there when the bullet enters the head he's been messing with. Would he be spit out like a seed as he was when he was inside the half-hypnotized Dumbo mopping the floor in 217? Or would he die along with the kid? For a moment, he thinks he's left it until too late. And the steady chiming he hears is what everyone hears when they exit this life. Then he's back in the main room of heads and skins with the Zap-It console in his sagging hand and Babineau's laptop in front of him. That's where the chiming is coming from. He looks at the screen and sees two messages. The first reads, 248 found. That's the good news. The second is the bad news. Repeater now offline. Freddy, he thinks, I didn't believe you had the guts. I really didn't. You bitch. His left hand gropes along the desk and closes on a ceramic skull filled with pens and pencils. He brings it up, meaning to smash it into the screen and destroy that infuriating message. What stops him is an idea. A horribly plausible idea. Maybe she didn't have the guts. Maybe somebody else killed the repeater. And who could that someone else be? Hodges, of course. The old debt ret. His fucking nemesis. Brady knows he isn't exactly right in the head, has known that for years now, and understands this could be nothing but paranoia. Yet it makes a degree of sense. Hodges stopped his gloating visits to room 217 almost a year and a half ago, but he was sniffing around the hospital just yesterday, according to Babineau. And he always knew I was faking, Brady thinks. He said so, time and time again. I know you're in there, Brady. Some of the suits from the DA's office had said the same thing, but with them, it had only been wishful thinking. They wanted to put him on trial and have done with him. Hodges, though, he said it with conviction. Brady says. And maybe this isn't such terrible news after all. Half of the Zap-Its Freddy loaded up and Babineau sent out are now active, which means most of those people will be as open to invasion as the little fag he just dealt with. Plus, there's the website. Once the Zap-It people start killing themselves with a little help from Brady Wilson Hartsfield, granted, the website will push others over the edge. Monkey see, monkey do. At first, it will just be the ones who were closest to doing it anyway, but they will lead by example,
and there will be many more. They'll march off the edge of life like stampeding buffalo going over a cliff. But still, Hodges. Brady remembers a poster he had in his room when he was a boy. If life hands you lemons, make lemonade. Words to live by, especially when you kept in mind that the only way to make them into lemonade was to squeeze the hell out of them. He grabs Z-Boy's old but serviceable flip phone and once again dials Freddy's number from memory. 14. Freddy gives a small scream when Boogie Woogie Bugle Boy starts tootling away from somewhere in the apartment. Holly puts a gentling hand on her shoulder and looks a question at Hodges. He nods and follows the sound, with Jerome on his heels. Her phone is on top of her dresser, amid a clutter of hand cream, zigzag rolling papers, roach clips, and not one but two good-sized bags of pot. The screen says Z-Boy, but Z-Boy, once known as Library Al Brooks, is currently in police custody and not likely to be making any calls. "Hello," Hodges says. "Is that you, Dr. Babineau?" Nothing. Or almost. Hodges can hear breathing. "Or should I call you Dr. Z?" Nothing. "How about Brady? Will that work?" He still can't quite believe this in spite of everything Freddy has told them, but he can believe that Babineau has gone schizo and actually thinks that's who he is. "Is it you, asshole?" The sound of the breathing continues for another 2 or 3 seconds, then it's gone. The connection has been broken.
15. "It's possible, you know," Holly says. She has joined them in Freddy's cluttered bedroom. "That it really could be Brady. I mean, personality projection is well documented. In fact, it's the second most common cause of so-called demonic possession. The most common being schizophrenia. I saw a documentary about it on..."
"No," Hodges says. "Not possible. Not."
"Don't blind yourself to the idea. Don't be like Miss Pretty Gray Eyes."
"What's that supposed to mean?" "Oh, God, now the tendrils of pain are reaching all the way down to his balls."
"That you shouldn't turn away from the evidence just because it points in a direction you don't want to go. You know Brady was different when he regained consciousness. He came back with certain abilities most people don't have. Telekinesis may only have been one of them."
"I never saw him actually moving shit around."
"But you believe the nurses who did, don't you?"
Hodges is silent, head lowered, thinking. "Answer," Jerome says. His tone is mild, but Hodges can hear impatience underneath. "Yeah, I believed at least some of them. The level-headed ones like Becky Helmington. Their stories matched up too well to be fabrications."
"Look at me, Bill."
This request, no, this command, coming from Holly Gibney is so unusual that he raises his head.
"Do you really believe Babineau reconfigured the Zappits and set up that website?"
"I don't have to believe it. He got Freddy to do those things."
"Not the website,"
a tired voice says. They look around. Freddy is standing in the doorway.
"If I'd set it up, I could shut it down. I just got a thumb drive with all the website goodies on it from Dr. Z, plugged it in and uploaded it. But once he was gone, I did a little investigating."
"Started with a DNS lookup, right?"
Holly says.
Freddy nods. "Girl's got some skills."
To Hodges, Holly says,
"DNS stands for Domain Name Server. It hops from one server to the next, like using stepping stones to cross a creek, asking, 'Do you know this site?' It keeps going and keeps asking until it finds the right server."
Then, to Freddy,
"But once you found the IP address, you still couldn't get in."
"Nope,"
Holly says.
"I'm sure Babineau knows a lot about human brains, but I doubt very much if he has the computer smarts to lock up a website like that."
"I was just hired help," Freddy says. "It was Z-Boy who brought me the program for retooling the Zappits. written down like a recipe for coffee cake or something, and I'd bet you $1,000 that all he knows about computers is how to turn them on, assuming he can find the button and back, and navigate to his favorite porn sites.
Hodges believes her about that much. He's not sure the police will when they finally catch hold of this thing, but Hodges does. And don't be like Miss Pretty Gray Eyes. That stung. It stung like hell.
Also, Freddy says, there was a double dot after each step in the program directions. Brady used to do that. I think he learned it when he was taking computer classes in high school.
Holly grabs Hodges' wrists. There's blood on one of her hands from patching Freddy's wound. Along with her other bells and whistles, Holly is a clean freak, and that she's neglected to wash the blood off says all that needs to be said about how fiercely she's working this.
Babineau was giving Hartsfield experimental drugs, which was unethical. But that's all he was doing, because bringing Brady back was all he was interested in.
You don't know that for sure, Hodges says. She's still holding him, more with her eyes than her hands, because she's ordinarily averse to eye contact. It's easy to forget how burning that gaze can be when she turns it up to 11 and pulls the knobs off.
There's really just one question, Holly says. Who's the suicide prince in this story? Felix Babineau or Brady Hartsfield?
Freddy speaks in a dreamy, sing-songy voice.
Sometimes Dr. Z was just Dr. Z, and sometimes Z-Boy was just Z-Boy. Only then, it was like both of them were on drugs. When they were wide awake, though, it wasn't them. When they were awake, it was Brady inside. Believe what you want, but it was him. It's not just the double dots or the back-slanted printing. It's everything. I worked with that skeevy motherfucker, I know.
She steps into the room.
And now, if none of you amateur detectives object, I'm going to roll myself another joint.
16. On Babineau's legs, Brady paces the big living room of heads and skins, thinking furiously. He wants to go back into the world of the Zap-It. Wants to pick a new target and repeat the delicious experience of pushing someone over the edge, but he has to be calm and serene to do that, and he's far from either. Hodges. Hodges in Freddy's apartment. And will Freddy spill her guts? Friends and neighbors, does the sun rise in the east? There are two questions as Brady sees it. The first is whether or not Hodges can take down the website. The second is whether or not Hodges can find him out here in the Willywags. Brady thinks the answer to both questions is yes. But the more suicides he causes in the meantime, the more Hodges will suffer. When he looks at it in that light, he thinks that Hodges finding his way out here could be a good thing. It could be making lemonade from lemons. In any case, he has time. He's many miles north of the city, and he's got Winter Storm Eugenie on his side. Brady goes back to the laptop and confirms that Z the End is still up and running. He checks the visitors count. Over 9,000 now, and most of them, but by no means all, will be teenagers interested in suicide. That interest peaks in January and February, when dark comes early and it seems spring will never arrive. Plus, he's got Zap-It Zero, and with that he can work on plenty of kids personally. With Zap-It Zero, getting to them is as easy as shooting fish in a barrel. Pink fish, he thinks, and Snickers. Calmer now that he sees a way of dealing with the old debt wretch should he try showing up like the cavalry in the last reel of a John Wayne Western, Brady picks up the Zap-It and turns it on. As he studies the fish, a fragment of some poem read in high school occurs to him, and he speaks it aloud. Oh, do not ask, what is it? Let us go and make our visit. He closes his eyes. The zipping pink fish become zipping red dots, each one a bygone concert goer who is, at this very moment,
studying his or her gift, zap it, and hoping to win prizes. Brady picks one, brings it to a halt, and watches it bloom like a rose.